911, what's your emergency?
My name is Colby Weathers. I live in Wellington, Missouri, and I shot my father.
Okay, you said you shot your father?
Yes, he's just laying there and there's a ton of blood.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure he's dead.
On the morning of June 27th, 2012, 38-year-old Colby Weathers drove about 10 miles from her home of Wellington, Missouri, to a pawn shop in Odessa, Missouri. She bought a gun and drove back to Wellington. Colby walked into her parents' house. Her father was sitting at his computer. Tex Delena had his back turned when Colby shot him.
Is he conscious right now? Are you close to him?
I can't look at him.
Okay.
He's been laying on the kitchen floor since I did it.
Colby Weathers struggled with severe mental illness for years. She had been in and out of hospitals for psychiatric treatment. She told the 911 dispatcher,
I'm not sane. I've been having a lot of problems. I'm not violent. I don't want to hurt anybody else, I swear. I know I'm going to get arrested. I know, but I'm not. I'll be standing out on the front porch. I've been insane for a long time.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Colby Weathers should have never had a gun. There are federal laws already on the books intended to thwart tragedies just like this. But those laws have weaknesses. And the federal agencies charged with enforcing those gun laws have weaknesses too. And those weaknesses are by design.
I always felt like that she was on a cliff hanging on by her fingertips and she was going to fall anytime.
Janet Delena is Colby's mother. Janet says Colby herself had never really been into firearms. But one day in May 2012, she came home with a gun. That shocked her parents, and they took it away. But Janet worried Colby would try to buy another one, so she called the chief of police for help.
And he said, oh my God, he said, nobody needs a gun less than her. I said, I know, what can I do? And he said, well, I'll make some phone calls for you.
Janet was too scared to wait. She called the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the agency charged with enforcing national gun laws. ATF didn't help. They told her to call the FBI, so she did.
But he said the only thing you can do is to get your doctor to send the medical records and have her added to the list.
The FBI agent was referring to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which can contain limited information about a person's mental health history that might disqualify them from owning a firearm.
But unless the doctor sends the medical records to them, their hands are tied. And he said, that's where we're stuck, with doctors not sending the medical records. And I said, well, what if she buys a gun again? And he said, ma'am, I don't know what to tell you. He said, I really don't know what to tell you.
So Janet made a last-ditch effort. On June 25th, 2012, Janet called Odessa Gun and Pawn, the place where Colby had bought that first gun. Court records show she spoke with store manager Derek Dady, the man who had sold the gun to Colby.
I told him the whole situation and to please not sell her gun. I said, you know, this is her social security number. I said, if you want me to come in, I'll bring a picture, whatever. But I said, she cannot have a gun. And they just, well, if somebody comes in to buy a gun, we have to sell it to them. And hung up on me. And I was like, at this point, I was like, I don't know what to do. I just flat don't know what to do.
2 days later, June 27th, 2012, Janet was at work. Her husband, Tex, stepped out for a few minutes to buy gas for the lawnmower. And while they were gone, Colby got in the car and drove back to Odessa Gun and Pawn. Working in the store that day, manager Derek Dady. In Missouri, licensed gun dealers are not required to sell weapons to everyone. State law says that dealers can refuse a sale if they, quote, choose in their individual judgment to not complete the sale or transfer of a firearm for articulable reasons specific to that transaction, end quote. And one of those articulable reasons? The buyer could use the weapon to harm themselves. Court records show that in the call just 48 hours earlier, Janet had pleaded with Dady, saying that Colby had already tried to take her own life. "I'm begging you as a mother," Janet said. "If she comes back in, please don't sell her a gun." But when Colby came back in, Dady sold her a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol and a box of ammunition. Colby Weathers had recently been put on a high dose of new medication. It wasn't working. Janet remembers calling the doctor and saying Colby was 10 times worse than she'd ever been. On June 27th, when Colby bought the gun, store manager Derek Dady said Colby looked nervous and in a hurry, according to court records. Janet says Colby then drove to a local convenience store for a pack of cigarettes.
There was a customer in the store, was a teacher at the high school, so he knew her, and then the little clerk, and both of them testified that she was completely lost, just completely out of it. You could tell there was something wrong with her.
Less than 1 hour later, Colby drove home and shot her father in the back.
She doesn't have a whole lot of memories of it. She was in such a fugue state. She said it wasn't even Dad. It was like, you've got to kill that demon. You've got to kill that demon. You've got to kill that demon.
Colby called 911. She told the dispatcher she wanted to kill herself.
Okay, you said father?
Yes, but I'm trying to kill myself first.
Okay, where's your gun right now, ma'am?
I don't know. I put it down and I can't remember where I put it.
Colby Weathers was charged with murder. In September 2014, she pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. A judge accepted her plea and committed her to a Missouri mental health facility. She's been there ever since. Colby has finally received a proper diagnosis and is now receiving effective treatment for bipolar schizoaffective disorder. Odessa Gun and Pawn ran the federal background check on Colby each time she bought a gun. And because Colby's mental health records were never put into the federal reporting system, Colby passed the background check both times. But official ATF guidance instructs firearms dealers that they should not rely exclusively on the results of a federal background check when choosing whether to make a sale. However, in court, Charles Dolshall, owner of Odessa Gun and Pawn, testified that he instructed employees to never deny sales to anyone who passed the background check. Odessa Gun and Pawn was also already well known to federal firearms regulators. ATF had cited the dealer many times for violating federal gun laws. According to court documents, in 2010, ATF cited the gun dealer for 15 violations. In 2014, 2 years after Colby killed her father, ATF cited Odessa Gun and Pawn 225 times. Janet Delena sued Odessa Gun and Pawn for negligent entrustment. They agreed to a $2.2 million settlement in 2016. The store remains in business and retains its federal license to sell firearms. Janet believes her husband should be alive today. She says laws already on the books should have stopped Colby from getting a gun, but they didn't, because something else has stopped those laws from working.
And how sad is that? How sad is that, that there are more people out there like me in the same situation trying to get help for their sick loved one, and then tragedy happens, and oh, you know, she murdered somebody. I guess she really needs help. That's the tragedy. That's a tragedy.
Janet Delena in Wellington, Missouri. Champ Barton is a reporter at The Trace, an independent nonprofit newsroom that covers guns in America. And he's in New York, and he joins us now. Champ, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So as you heard, Janet's story really shines a bright light on two large issues. There's the gaps in the federal background check system. And then there's also gun dealers who repeatedly violate federal regulations, but are allowed to stay open. Now, Champ, you and a team at The Trace investigated years of ATF data on gun dealers. So let's talk about that for a second. Gun dealers that had repeated citations, what percentage of them were actually shut down by ATF?
A very small percentage. I think it was somewhere in the realm of like 3% were supposed to be revoked, and then more than half of those revocations were downgraded by more senior personnel at the ATF. So it was somewhere around like a 0.5% to 1%, I think, were ultimately revoked.
0.5% to 1%. Okay. Out of what? Are we talking about potentially thousands of licensed dealers, or
what? this is just the data set that we had, and that data set contains something north of 2,000 inspections. There's obviously many more inspections that are conducted. The ATF said that in an overlapping time period with the records that we had, they had actually done like twice as many inspections, but these were the records that we had. But it's a fairly large sample size, and so you do have this like vanishingly small percentage that actually get revoked. Of thousands of inspections.
Even after, and these are the licensed gun dealers we're talking about that have been repeatedly cited by ATF. Now, you talked about the inspections. There are what, more than 130,000 federal firearms licensees in this country? How many inspectors are there?
There's not that many inspectors. I think that the agency had a staff of something north of like 500 or something inspectors, if I'm remembering correctly. That might be wrong, but I know that the agency was supposed to add more inspectors around 2016 after a mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. But Republicans, I'm fairly certain, blocked that effort.
Right. So we're 500 or so. We're seeing a little bit more recently, maybe around 700 ATF inspectors. But again, that's out of 130,000 federal firearms dealers in this country that those inspectors are supposed to oversee. So this hour, what we're doing is we're taking a look at the laws that are already on the books regarding gun safety in America, and the agency charged with enforcing those laws, the ATF, and whether both those laws and the agency have weaknesses in them by design. So Champ Barton, hold on here for just a second. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Champ Barton from The Trace is with us. And today we're talking about this.
The only thing that should be changing is that government enforce the laws that are already on the books.
We need to enforce the thousands of gun laws already on the books.
But if we can enforce the laws that already exist, the tens of thousands of gun laws that are on the books right now, it might create a very significant deterrent.
Under President Obama and Vice President Biden, gun prosecutions actually went down. So what is the use of more gun laws if they're not going to enforce the ones we currently have?
Enforce the laws already on the books, a question that has been asked again and again and is still asked. Well, in January 2016, President Obama answered.
You know, one of the most frustrating things that I hear is when people say, who are opposed to any further laws, why don't you just enforce the laws that are on the books? And those very same members of Congress then cut ATF budgets to make it impossible to enforce the law.
So we're talking about whether ATF and the gun laws it's supposed to enforce are being weakened by design. Now, Champ, I have a couple more questions about what ATF does regarding inspecting licensed gun dealers in this country. And by the way, Paige Sutherland, our producer who put it together this hour, did some digging, some comparative digging, and noted that there are slightly more than 18,000 McDonald's in the United States, but there are, again, 130,000 federal firearms dealers, licensed firearms dealers in this country. So that's just kind of to give people a sense of the number of businesses we're talking about here. But it's a really small number that are repeatedly associated with selling guns that end up being used in crimes, right? So, like, for example, there's one gun store in Georgia that's responsible for selling some 6,000 guns that were used in crimes in a five-year period between 2014 to 2019. What's stopping ATF from shutting down a place like that?
I mean, it's hard to say. There seems to be sort of a culture at the ATF inspections division, at least, of sort of granting gun dealers the benefit of the doubt in most scenarios. So in our reporting, you know, we had found that the ATF had let dealers off the hook for like a variety of like seemingly contradictory explanations. Some dealers had been in business too short a period of time, and the agents were like, the inspectors rather were like, well, you've been in business too short, you know, we'll give you, you know, let you off the hook for this one time since you haven't been around that long. Others had been in business so long, and the justification was they had been in business for a really long time, and therefore like they had some sort of goodwill cashed away, and then they could be let off for that reason. But at the end of the day, I mean, it seems to me from my reporting, like there's just like a general unwillingness to, I guess, wade into what seems to be like a difficult political fray by cracking down on these dealers and shutting them down, which will possibly invite the wrath of, you know, the NRA or the NSSF, who may, you know, be willing to sue on behalf of that dealer and make sort of a PR spectacle of it, and that can obviously affect the agency's funding.
Mm. A general unwillingness, even though there seems to be ample evidence that taking action against gun dealers that repeatedly violate, you know, federal law or are associated with a high number of crimes that end up being used in crimes that could actually benefit public safety. So here's David Blake Johnson. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Central Missouri. And Johnson and his research partner tallied all the federal firearms licensees, or FLLs, these are the licensed gun dealers, per county in the United States that existed between 2003 and 2019. And then they compared that number to the number of gun homicides in those same areas within 100 square miles of the dealers to see what impact the number of gun dealers had.
There's a positive relationship between gun dealers and gun homicides. As gun dealers fall, a couple of years later, homicides fall. And as gun dealers increase, well, then a few years later, homicides also start to increase. And we're fairly certain that this is being driven by gun prevalence, because if you look at non-gun homicides, I mean, they've been declining since the early 2000s. According to the CDC, there were nearly 20,000 gun homicides in 2020 and 25,000 homicides. And that 20,000 number is roughly equal to the total number of homicides in 2019. So, I mean, it's a gun problem.
According to Johnson as well, between 2005 to 2010, there was actually a drop in the number of gun dealers, and therefore he saw a correlated drop in gun homicides. Now, Johnson told us that one of the big factors for the decline was that ATF was making a lot of changes in how they inspected gun dealers, making more inspections in general. Now, Champ, you reported on places like Chicago in particular. Now, Chicago doesn't have a lot of licensed dealers in Cook County necessarily, but just outside the county, the density of gun dealers rises. So what's your thoughts on this about the impact of the number of licensed gun dealers, homicide rates, and the impact that inspections could have?
Right. I mean, as the researcher said, the issue here is prevalence. I think that something that often gets sort of butchered in the discourse is between people who are sort of in favor of more gun ownership and those who are in favor of less gun ownership, is that when people make claims like this, that reducing the number of gun dealers is going to reduce homicides, it seems like these people on the sort of right side of the spectrum would say that you're inferring, essentially implicating that a gun causes somebody to commit a crime. And that's obviously not the case. I mean, there are root causes of gun violence that are driving people to commit crimes, and the gun is just making it, making them more effective in whatever crime they're intending to commit. But at the end of the day, there's so much research right now to show that when you reduce the prevalence of firearms in a community, you reduce the ability of members of that community to commit homicides and commit suicides effectively, and so those rates drop. And inspections are just one way that the ATF, the regulatory agency that's supposed to oversee the gun industry, could reduce access to firearms among criminals or among people who are feel driven by desperation or need to carry a gun and to maybe use it, by reducing the access to dealers who are willing to sell in some of these like shadier transactions that may be straw purchases or that may be gun traffickers or whatever it might be.
Hmm. Well, we reached out to ATF in particular to help us, to send us a statement on their view on some of these issues. And one of the things they sent back in a statement was saying that they say that over the past three decades, ATF has not been funded and staff commensurate with staffing increases received by other DOJ law enforcement agencies. So they just say they don't have the people to do the job they've been tasked with. So Champ Barton at the Trace, hang on here for just a minute, because I now want to turn to David Shipman. He was an ATF special agent for a quarter century, for 25 years, monitoring firearm trafficking from Virginia to New York City. He was also President Biden's nominee to be the next director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. But in September, his nomination was withdrawn due to unified public Republican opposition and the administration's inability to get Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and John Tester to throw their support behind him. And David Shipman joins us from Washington. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
Mr. Shipman, I actually first want to talk with you in detail about some of the rules that ATF has to operate under. I mean, there are federal appropriations restrictions on ATF that have an influence on how much it can, in fact, enforce the laws it's meant to enforce, such as the ATF is not allowed to disclose trace data to the public. Can you tell me more about some of these restrictions?
Sure. And what's important is I worked at ATF before these restrictions and after. And so I have a really good view of what the before and after of this was. And so trace data is the means by which ATF determines where a gun found in crime came from. It could be a corrupt dealer. It could be stolen. It could be manufactured, unlawfully. There are a lot of different ways. And so it's a very important tool to not only provide leads to law enforcement, but also get to the heart of the matter. What is fueling gun violence? And ATF used to put out annual reports that would show what are the most popular brand of guns for criminals and where do they come from? And this was so threatening to an industry that profited by selling certain guns to criminals that they got like-minded legislators to pass a law to keep this secret from the public. It would almost be as if the auto industry was having a problem with gas tanks on a certain brand of car exploding, and Congress covered up what cars were exploding.
Mm. So, again, I want to go in detail into some of these restrictions because I'm not sure many people know. For example, the federal government has banned ATF from putting records obtained from licensed gun dealers when they go out of business into an electronic searchable database. So ATF does not have a searchable database of these records. They're like on microfilm and what employees have to go in and like search by hand.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's in the dark. It looks like a 1970s library. And then again, this is not because of the absence of technology. In fact, many gun dealers today do use automated systems in which the form completed by the gun purchaser is in the computer. And actually, it's even worse than Senator Booker said early on. Mm-hmm. ATF has to use the computers they have to take the computer file that they're given from the dealer and make it not useful. So we're using tax dollars to make ATF unable to immediately determine the owner of a gun, the same way as an ATF agent we used to solve bombings, like the First World Trade Center in Oklahoma City, where we found a vehicle identification number on the rental van that was used. We plugged that number in a computer, and we were able to quickly find out who rented the gun. We can't do that for guns. In fact, guns aren't even required to have unique serial numbers like your credit card.
And again, so this is by design. The federal government has built this in to limit ATF's capacity here. And I'm going to just lean on the Traces reporting a little bit more, because here's how they describe it. That to perform a search, ATF investigators have to find the specific index number of a former dealer, then search records chronologically for the gun they're looking for. That might require reviewing thousands of images before they find the weapon. I mean, this, there's no keyword searches allowed, no sorting by date, no sorting by any field, all strictly prohibited. I mean, I can go to the local library, I could pull up my cell phone and do a Google search. That's a million times more sophisticated than this.
Of course. You know, today we have the technology that if Congress, the majority in Congress, intended ATF to be effective, they would require gun dealers to put a Q code on every gun that would allow law enforcement to use their iPhone to scan it and immediately know who the buyer is. I mean, this has nothing to do with talking about who should have guns or who shouldn't. This just is if you got a gun at a homicide scene, I would think 99.9% of Americans would think that law enforcement, like on TV, could immediately determine whose gun it is. They can't.
They can't. Okay.
Purposely. By design.
By design. So in addition, there's a ban, and this is, again, through appropriations restrictions, a ban on ATF transferring any of its functions, missions, or activities to other agencies or departments. What else here?
And that's an important one, yeah. Because, I mean, if we say that we've been looking at ATF for 30 years and it's been made ineffective, we should talk about, well, could some other federal agency do it more effectively? That conversation can't have. I've always advocated that, especially as we relook at the war on drugs, that maybe the way around this rioter is to actually merge DEA into ATF, end the drug war, and name this new agency the Bureau of Violent Crime. That would give ATF the resources to focus on what Americans want, is safer communities.
Okay. So what impact do you think that these restrictions have had on ATF's ability to do the job it's charged to do?
Well, I think the American public wants law enforcement to prevent crime. It's not like watching a BBC murder series where every show starts with a murder and then they solve it. You know, good law enforcement would prevent the crime from ever happening. But these restrictions have rendered ATF really stands for after the fact. ATF is good at catching a killer after the fact, but we'd want to prevent that from ever happening. The only way to do that is hold the industry accountable and make sure that gun doesn't end up in the killer's hands. That would require different laws, different resources, but that's what the American public expects, and that's what the gun industry doesn't want to have happen, and it's not happening.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Now, we spoke with other long-term and veteran ATF agents in our research for this hour. One of them was Joseph Bisbee, and he worked at ATF for more than 25 years. And he told us there's a lot of issues at the Bureau beyond what we just talked about. But he saw the biggest problem as being a lack of federal gun prosecutions.
Yeah, I was specifically told by certain federal prosecutors that, you know, the judges don't like to prosecute certain gun laws and the juries don't like certain gun laws because what it boils down to is a paper violation, and they don't see how that relates to firearms-related violent crime. And so, you know, a lot of the gun cases don't get prosecuted. And so if they're not getting prosecuted, then some people feel, well, then why do I even investigate it? If I'm going to put all this time and effort and risk into a gun investigation, and at the end of the day, it's not going to get prosecuted, why are we going to spend all these resources on it?
So that's Joseph Bisbee, who worked at ATF for more than 25 years. David Shipman, answer that question. Why would they spend all the resources on this if the prosecutions aren't happening? And why aren't they happening?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, when you were talking about accountability of gun dealers, the law already makes most of the violations that a gun dealer would have as a misdemeanor. And I can tell you, in federal court, misdemeanors are rarely prosecuted. So that is by design right there. Also, you would think that ATF would be able to enforce a firearms trafficking law. The law doesn't exist. And that, too, is by design. We have drug trafficking. We have human trafficking laws, stolen nuclear materials. Why isn't there a gun trafficking law? Well, because we don't want to hold gun traffickers accountable. And that's inexcusable.
Well, David Shipman, stand by here for just a second. And Champ Barton with The Trace, I appreciate you listening along. I'm going to want to hear more from you when we come back from a quick break. Today, we're talking about those laws that are already on the books and the bureau charged with enforcing them, ATF, and whether not only the laws, but ATF itself are restricted from doing its job by design. More in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the question of why does the United States not do a better job of enforcing the gun laws that are already on the books? Well, the answer lies in part with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the bureau charged with, the agency charged with enforcing those gun laws. Well, that agency has been weakened by design, and we're looking at what that design is this hour. I'm joined today by David Shipman. He was a special agent at ATF for 25 years. He was also President Biden's nominee to be the head of ATF, but in September of last year, that nomination was withdrawn due to unified Republican opposition and the fact that the Biden administration could not get a couple of key Democrats in the Senate to throw their support behind David Shipman. He was also senior policy advisor at Giffords, the gun violence prevention organization founded by former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Champ Barton is also with us, a reporter with The Trace that covers gun violence in America. Now, there's a moment from one of your nomination hearings, David Shipman, that I want to play, actually. So this is in May of 2021, and Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah asked a question about a statement that you had posted on Reddit back in 2020. And here's Senator Lee.
Quote, while at ATF, I conducted studies involving people who failed background checks to determine how many later committed crimes with a gun. Many did. This is a perfect opportunity to arrest people before committing crimes rather than responding after the fact, close quote. I find this statement very troubling, especially troubling for someone who's been nominated to serve as the ATF director. Even before you get to the Second Amendment, this violates our most fundamental rules of due process, talking about a desire to arrest people before committing crimes rather than after the fact. It's not how our criminal justice system works.
David Shipman, do you want to Explain what you were talking about in that Reddit post.
Yeah, there's a little stress having to relive that hearing, but it, you know, this one, you know, I have a definite answer to. What I was talking about is anytime someone goes into a gun store and lies during the course of attempting to acquire a gun, they commit a serious federal felony. And I believe that it would be very useful in this prevention attempt to find out which of those people were buying a gun because their intention was to commit a more heinous crime and charge them with that paperwork violation before they killed someone. I believe the senator understood exactly what I was saying, and this is part of the frustration is we don't have everyone with the same goodwill at the table.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the difficulties ATF has had in getting a director, an official director, not an acting one, in a few minutes. But there's also an additional point here that in 2017, or fiscal year 2017, the federal background check system did actually deny 112,000 transactions. ATF, of those 112 transactions, ATF referred about 12,000 to field divisions for further investigation. Out of those 12,000, though, U.S. attorneys' offices prosecuted only 12 cases, so way less than 1% were actually prosecuted. Champ Barton, you've been listening along patiently to the things David Chipman has been saying about ATF's weaknesses by design. And I'm just wondering, what else do you see sort of in this net with many holes?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the thing that strikes me most about this whole conversation is that it seems that the tack that many Republicans in Congress have taken and that the gun lobby has taken is to attempt to try to balance, you know, as they would say, balance security and freedom, and that you need to sort of sacrifice some security in order to get more freedom for people, and the freedom being the right to own a gun. But I think what gets overlooked is that the current state of affairs, where many of these dealers are allowed to operate essentially without significant impunity, or without getting their licenses revoked when they violate the law and things like that, is that you have whole communities that don't have significant freedom to move freely within their public spaces, to grow up and go to college and do these different things because violence is like a blanket over their neighborhood, and it holds them back for in a variety of ways, and I think that really needs to be taken into account. The other thing is that the fear that there's going to be some sort of gun registry by trying to sort of automate this record keeping in the way that many Democrats have wanted the ATF to do over the past decade or so. Is sort of misplaced. These records are already automated by private companies. Almost dozens and dozens and dozens of dealers contract with these private companies that automate record keeping for their Form 4473s, the forms that gun purchasers need to fill out when they buy a gun. And those databases are searchable. Mm-hmm. And they interface with the ATF so that the ATF can then reach out to those individuals and then get, speedy traces back. And I just think that, it gets forgotten that these records are automated. They're just not automated by the federal government. And I don't know why people are more comfortable with some private company that has no, oversight, public oversight, essentially holding the keys to this data rather than, a government agency, which at least, you get a vote and a say in what they do with it.
David Chipman, would you hazard an answer as to why?
Well, they don't want ATF to be effective. I mean, having a registry, just like I pointed out with cars, is like the fundamental thing you need to do when you find a gun used in crime. And we should remember, as Champ just pointed out, the gun industry itself has a registry of guns. It's every time you send in your warranty card. And what they did with that data, it's been reported, is they sold it to Cambridge Analytica so that our elections could be attacked. So, the threat is, as Champ pointed out, doubt is always out there. I think that it's much better to hold the government accountable. We've had a registry of machine guns since the 1930s. And the first thing I was taught as an agent is I would commit a felony if I ever revealed who was on that list. I didn't.
Mm. Well, once again, we did reach out to ATF to see if they would send us a statement and answer some questions that we had. And they did. And one of the things that ATF now is, you know, is stating, and they've been stating this for a while, but they reiterated it, is that they say that they simply have not been given the resources to do the job they've been asked to do. And they compared ATF's resources to the DEA or FBI. And they said that, you know, since the 1970s, DEA has had an addition of a 254% increase in the number of DEA employees. The FBI has had a 75% increase, but the ATF has had a 41% increase. So they're just saying that it's not commensurate with the job. But interestingly also, ATF told us that just to do the inspections, which we've spent quite a bit of time talking about, they would need more than 800 more new inspectors annually. So that's interesting. But we wanted to find out what the culture within ATF was a little bit more on this point. So we spoke with Mark Jones. He is a retired supervisory special agent at the Bureau, worked there for 2 decades. And he actually told us he saw a culture that differed between the enforcement side of the agency and the regulatory side, between, you know, the folks in charged with inspecting gun dealers and the special agent law enforcement officers. And he said instead of working together, he found often they were at odds.
There was just a lot of sort of animosity between the job series, jealousies. I mean, the inspectors were always trying to get badges and pepper spray and, you know, get use of, we ended up doing some use of force training for them, but it was just a second class job series after the agents took over and has remained so, which is really the problem.
David Chip and Mark Jones also told us that it was so bad that agents often referred to the inspectors as, quote, booger eaters.
It's almost a high school-like culture where you had jocks versus geeks. And, you know, the reality is that in the prevention efforts, in many ways, the regulatory responsibilities are more important to that. Because if you have an unregulated industry, then agents are always responding after the fact, after a bad guy has a gun. It is true. They're just under-resourced. And what you didn't bring out is these same inspectors have to regulate the entire explosives industry as well. So I don't know about you, but I would not go to a restaurant that was inspected by food inspectors once every 10 years. And so that is about how often a federal firearms licensee is inspected. And again, that's by design. We could fund ATF to inspect licensed gun dealers every year. And until we do that, things aren't going to change.
Well, ATF still does not have a Senate-confirmed director. It's not moving forward, even at the moment. Now, I want to play a moment from last year. Again, David Chipman, this was in the process of you trying to get confirmed, which ultimately didn't happen. And here's Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois.
In the history of the Alcohol and Tobacco Firearms Agency, there was only one person who served as the head director of the agency. Otherwise, over and over again, it goes without any leadership. You say, well, is that just an accident that this agency never has a director? I don't think it's an accident at all. You see, the gun lobby, when they want to make their case against new gun laws, always say the same thing. Well, just enforce the laws on the book. You don't need new laws. Enforce the laws on the books. If you bought that premise, then the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency is one of the law agencies that does it. So if you can weaken this agency, fewer agents, fewer employees, fewer supervisors, no director, then the actual enforcement that's being done by this agency is diminished.
So just to underscore something, ATF has not had a confirmed director in 6 years. And since 2006, when the director position was made subject to Senate confirmation. 2006, ATF has only had one confirmed director in all that time. David Shipman, what impact is that having on the agency?
Well, just imagine if we hadn't had a Secretary of Defense for that amount of time. I mean, it's extraordinary, but what Senator Durbin didn't lean into is the fact that actually ATF has had an acting leader selected by the gun industry to head ATF. And so that's even a worse situation. And I saw that quite clearly during my process, that it was the industry, through its connections in the Senate, were objecting to me becoming director because they were satisfied with the current acting director because he did things that were agreeable to the gun industry itself.
Champ Barton, you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think like this gets to a really, really crucial point to understanding this entire problem, which is that it's very easy to point to the gun lobby and say, look, the gun lobby is lobbying for all of these, you know, horrible restrictions or bans on sharing data or whatever it might be. But the question you have to ask yourself is whose interests are they serving? And while the NRA has maybe like, pulled away from being sort of exactly the mouthpiece for the gun industry per se, because they've gotten a lot of political power got a lot of political power over the past decade, all of these bans and restrictions and efforts to weaken the ATF, they're the interest of gun manufacturers, gun wholesalers, and to, I guess, a lesser extent, gun dealers. And that's what these interest groups like the NRA and the NSSF, that's whose interests they're representing. And so I think that the sort of industry needs to, bear a little more culpability or at least discussion when it comes to why we have the sort of milquetoast enforcement that we have now, why we have some of these restrictions on sharing data that seem to be an obstacle to reducing gun death in the country. These ultimately come back to powerful corporations who are concerned primarily with their bottom line. And I think that's something that, everyone needs to consider more thoroughly.
And Magna, if I could just add a fine point. Earlier, you sort of laid out as sort of the demons in my nomination, Senators Tester and Manchin. And I think that's off point. I mean, we need to look to Maine. Senators Collins and King are really the people who sabotaged my nomination. And they explained to me why out loud. So this isn't a secret. Senator Collins said that I had been disrespectful to AR-15 owners, even though I carried an AR-15 as a SWAT team member protecting this country. And Senator King said that he could not vote for me because I had not received the endorsement of the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the people that I would have been sworn to regulate. I mean, I also didn't bring to the table MS-13's endorsement. And then as I walked out the door, Senator King said, you just have to understand gun violence isn't a problem in Maine. So this is our problem, is that even these moderates, senators, a state like Maine is deciding how we're going to address gun violence in this entire country.
We have about a minute left, David Shipman. There is some effort in Congress right now, of course, mainly among Democrats, to add new laws. Is it misdirected? Because it sounds as if if ATF were strengthened, some of those appropriations restrictions removed, et cetera, that the very thing people have been saying, why can't you enforce the laws on the books, could happen, and it could have a positive impact in reducing gun violence in America. Is that where Congress should be focusing its efforts?
Yeah, my fear is that the laws on the books are really weighted at targeting communities of color. And so I'd be very concerned about going all in. And we saw that in the sessions period. So I think it's a yes and. We got to keep going forward trying to pass reasonable gun laws. But at the same time, we really have to rethink how ATF approaches the job and provide ATF leadership that supports the president's agenda. So we got to do both.
Well, David Shipman was a special agent at the ATF for 25 years, former nominee to head the Bureau. His nomination was withdrawn in September. David Shipman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Champ Barton, reporter with The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom that covers the gun industry. We have links to their reporting at onpointradio.org. Champ, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.